Hi, and welcome to The Art of Relating. I'm your host, Zach Schwartz, and we are going into installment number 14, which is the second week, talking about addictions. I'm a psychologist out there, but in here we're learning a system together for effectively interacting in a humanistic way. It's very efficient and it's very successful if you can integrate the patterns and concepts that we discuss. Remember, insight alone won't get you there. You have to internalize, get it into the habits of how you think, and you have to integrate, get it into the habits of how you behave. That takes work on your part as well as mine. Remember, if you have questions about the show or comments to add, please write me at zach@kepw.org, and I will share those questions and answer them during the next show. And also remember, you can visit dyneskills.com for books and trainings and workshops and more materials for helping you to internalize and integrate these concepts and skills. We're going to begin, as we always do, with grounding, because I think you should start everything you do with grounding. Grounding, centering, finding your free will, all one and the same, relaxed and centered. So your bottom half is your base, connects you to the ground, make it solid, make it strong, open your joints and muscles so you're connected to the earth. The top half of your body, relaxed but hold a shape that says, I have some power, I have some value, I have some confidence, centered but relaxed. And whenever you relax muscles, you let the energy or the chi flow through, and grounding is about letting any stored energy flow to the earth and connecting you to it. Then breathe. Two grounding breaths. Fill both chambers, bottom and top. Let it all go. A couple of those. And then shake out the kinks. Go to the places you chronically hold tight. Could be your neck or your hands or your jaw. And make sure it's not locked and that the muscles are as relaxed as you can get them. And finally, self-talk. And remember, your self-talk for grounding includes relaxers, affirmers, and unhookers. So first I say to myself, chill out, calm down. Then I say to myself, I'm a good person, I'm doing the best I can, I have value, two of those. And finally, and the trickiest part, is unhook. You want to step out of your, what I call, ego movie, and just be the consciousness of your soul for a minute. So some people just say it's not worth it, or it's no big thing. Other people say, I'm just a speck living on a speck. I'm only on the earth for a second. To learn some things is all I'm gonna keep. Whatever helps you to unhook, step out, take a moment's pause to help you to ground. And also remember, you have the right, one of your five interpersonal rights, to space, which means you may pause in interaction almost all the time, and that should be respected so that you can ground. So when you notice yourself feeling any tension or getting buttons pushed, or notice that in any of the people in any interaction, it's non-judgmental, it's go to neutral corners, it's call time, and take a moment to step back and ground yourself before you continue to interact. Now, last week we started talking about addiction, because addiction is something that has a deleterious effect on the art of relating. Causes people who are addicted to be dishonest, to feel weak, to be pulled, to be powerless, to be controlled by patterns of behavior that mostly they know are destructive or cost them more than they profit them. So we thought spending a couple of weeks on addiction would be useful. and we talked about the use, abuse, and habituation and addiction to anything that has coping value or carries power. So it doesn't have to be drugs. It could be money. It could be sex. It could be being taken care of. It could be a lot of things that all have an addictive potential. At any given moment, there are people who are using a substance. There are people who are abusing a substance. That means harm is being caused to their coping system by the use of that thing. There's habituation, which is a pattern of behavior, and you can learn, and we talked about impulse control as a way of practicing and installing mechanisms that help you to get out of habitual patterns and to establish new and more constructive ones when that's called for. And then there's addiction, and addiction literally means to me, I can't cope without that item. So I have to have it, and when I have to have it, it tends to control me. I have to do whatever I have to do to maintain it or get it. An example I used in a relationship was someone promising their partner they won't do cocaine anymore when they're already habituated or addicted to the substance, and that promise can't be kept. You can't promise you'll control something that you don't control. And so they get caught in the lie, or that hurts their trust because they promised they wouldn't. But when you think about what addiction means, they're going to say whatever they have to say. If they need their partner and want their family and they need the drug and have to have it, then when they're forced to make a choice, they will naturally tend to lie about what they're going to do about the substance. It's not their intent to lie. It's just not a recognition that that behavior is out of control. So the way I look at it, stepping out of an addiction, recovering from an addiction, involves two sort of major paths. One is to break the habit of use by cutting availability, by establishing a clean house, by having a phone list, by going to support groups. I am reinforcing my desire to not use. Cutting availability never makes it impossible to find the drug, but it does give you time at least to think, a chance to ground before it happens. If there's cocaine, say, downtown, I have a chance to think about what I'm doing before I go and get it. If it's sitting on the coffee table in front of me, I have almost no chance to think about it, and obviously much more likely to use it that moment. Impulse control we talked about, discovering your early warning system, making plans and practicing those plans about what to do when relapse seems imminent or as early as possible, when you notice you're in the process of danger, of moving back toward the substance or back toward the thing you're addicted to. That's as far as we got last week, but this week I want to talk about the other part of approaching addiction, which for me is rebuilding in a healthier way your coping system. And your coping system is all the ways, all the things, external and internal, that you use to get your needs met and get your desires met and have a healthier, happier life. All of those things, almost everything in your lifestyle, is part of your coping system. And developing a healthy coping system where that's broad as possible, that gets the job done, that meets your needs, is the goal of this kind of work. So a coping system breaks into what I call external elements and internal elements. External coping elements are all the things outside of yourself that can help you meet those needs. Everyone has needs, everyone has desires, everyone has stress. Sometimes getting those needs met can be frustrating or insufficient. We all develop ways to cope with those insufficiencies and to restore a system that gets those needs or desires met. So external elements are your house, your job, your car, your bank account, your friends, anything outside yourself, organizations you may belong to, activities you may indulge in that help you to cope, to get healthier, to meet your needs. The strong and nice thing about external elements is that they're objective, they're easy to define, they're easy to count. They can be strong when you're weak. They're measurable and easy to understand. The tough thing about external elements is that they're temporal. Everything that starts stops. Everything you have, you eventually don't have, can be replaced with other things, but those things too are temporal. So we get attached to coping with certain external elements, and then those elements are not available, and that creates a hole in my coping system, which sometimes is very difficult to replace. So they're easy to count, they're easy to define, but you have to deal with their temporalness, with their temporary energy that they come and they go. And it's nice to have a coping system that's broad enough and strong enough that you can get needs met multiple ways, which creates a kind of independence. And when you're independent, you have more personal power, power to negotiate with a partner, power to set boundaries that protect you. Power and independence are very linked together, and independence is very linked to having multiple ways to get your needs met within your coping system. Now, you also have internal coping elements: your sense of identity, your sense of purpose, your sense of humor, your ethics, your values, your intuition, what's inside of you that helps you cope. And the good thing about internal coping elements is that they're not temporal. You can take them to the grave with you. You can keep them forever if you wish. You don't have to change them if you don't want to, and you don't have to lose them. That's up to you. The tough thing about internal elements is that they're hard to define. If I ask a person how much money they have in the bank, say, they can tell me. If I ask a person what their sense of identity is, they kind of cock their head and look at me, and they're not sure how to answer and not sure what I mean by that, or a sense of purpose. These things are not as concrete, not as objective. They're harder to get a handle on, but they're absolutely worth having, and they keep you strong anytime, even when the externals are weak or not available. So one exercise that you can do with all this is make yourself a map of your coping system. It'll kind of look like a archery target, like concentric circles, rings to a center. And if you put your name at the center, something that marks your ego, then you can start to fill in items. The more centralized an item, the more important it is and more lasting it is within your coping system. Its coping value can be the highest. I save the first two rings for my internal elements, my sense of spirit, my sense of consciousness, my sense of purpose, my sense of identity. Things like that tend to go in my inner two circles. When I get to circle number three, I start to add the most important external elements. Could be my spouse or my occupation or career, my home, my children. Next ring out, I might put organizations I belong to, or social activities, or hobbies and pastimes. As I get out to the fifth or sixth ring, even say going fishing with my kid would be considered a coping activity, because it helps me relax, it gets me away from work, it supplies a little bit of food to the household for several reasons. Even an activity like that has coping value. So then, by looking at your map of your coping system, you can kind of see what's most important to you, what needs work, where you would add an item or two. Again, your goal is to get your needs met and your desires met as much as possible with a multiplicity of coping elements so you don't become too reliant on any one. Now notice that each item in my coping system has a certain, what I call, coping value, which is the amount that it helps me cope with my life and support myself, minus what it costs me to have that item. Nothing's free, my mother used to say. And so every coping element has a price. For example, I have a truck, and the truck is part of my coping system. And the truck helps me by carrying lumber and groceries and commuting me to work and giving rides to my families, and I use it every day to help get my needs met and help do what I want to do. And that's part of its coping value, but it also takes maintenance and money, and there are accidents and things break and there's gas, and so it costs me something to have that truck. Now, as long as the coping value of the truck is positive, that's to say it helps me more than it costs me, then I tend to want to keep the truck in my lifestyle, in my coping system. If it starts to cost me more than it helps me, then I start to question whether I should keep the truck or replace the truck or do something else to get those needs met because it's costing, in all ways, too much. Of course, one of the problems with addiction is that the longer I'm addicted to something, I need it for how it helps me cope, but the cost keeps getting higher and higher. The cost of the substance, the cost to my health, the cost to my family, the cost of my career. So I experience a deterioration in other parts of my coping system and in the strength of my coping system, yet I'm habituated enough and addicted enough that I can't imagine not using what I'm addicted to, not being able to put it down. I get stuck with a rising cost and a weaker coping value, and that of course leads to a very destructive future if I don't do something about it. Interestingly enough, if my experience with doing groups, recovery groups, therapy groups with addicts, is that when I ask them what the coping value of the substance is, they will tell me about the coping cost, how it's hurting them, why they should stop. But I'm really asking them the opposite question, to identify how it helps them cope. By reducing social anxiety, by giving them energy, by stopping their pain, etc. And if they can recognize what needs were being met by the use, then they can start to build appropriate coping structures to replace that thing they're addicted to, and find a healthier, better way to get those needs met. Now, a common term these days is the term codependence. A codependent person might be postured to be addicted to their partner. They have no real sense of identity or purpose or their own world, without having their partner to serve and meet the needs of. I should pause there and say that a lot of people use the term codependent. But let me give you a clear, from one psychologist's point of view, definition of what it is. Now remember, and we've talked about this at least once before in these last 14 segments of The Art of Relating, your reality is different than mine. My reality is built of maps that I've made of my experiences, and by the definition of how a map gets made and what a map is, each of our maps of even any one experience is different, and our experiences are different. And our collection of maps is the world that we live in. So each of our worlds is different. So if I get into a relationship like with my spouse, we are bringing two worlds together and joining forces to create a home, to meet each other's needs, to raise children, to make money, all of those things that go into what's included in a primary relationship. But we're bringing two worlds together. And in a healthy relationship, there's a balance of assertion and consideration. When I'm being assertive, I am making sure that my world gets respected. Remember, one of the rights is the right to perception, respect. And I have to get consideration from my partner, for the reality is I've constructed it in my head, and she also needs that same consideration. So when I'm being assertive, I am making sure my partner understands how I'm seeing things, and I'm making sure that a respect for how I'm seeing things is included in the decisions that we make together. That's all part of being assertive. The other part of the relationship is called consideration, and that's making sure that my partner's world is understood and included in negotiations. So even on a trivial thing, a relatively trivial, if I say, well, what do you want to have for dinner? And she says, I don't care, whatever. It's hard for me to consider her desires or her tastes or her preferences if she says nothing about what she wants to eat. Now, she might truly not care, and that's okay. She can, by proxy, let me decide, because she had. But I have to be careful when I walk on that ground, because it's hard to be considerate if most people don't share. So we have to share with each other. We each have to be assertive. And notice that the more assertive, say, she is, it works both ways, the more considerate I will tend to be. So assertion and consideration go together, like sitting on a seesaw, like more consideration. Is met by someone being more assertive. Now, sometimes some people think there's only one world and it's theirs. They have all assertion and no consideration. We call that narcissistic. So there's only one world and it's mine. You're just a character in it. I'm not considering your reality as separate and equally respectable. That's a kind of illness from a psychologist's point of view. The opposite of that, being just considerate and never assertive, there's only one world and it's yours, is called codependence. It's different than being dependent, where you need things that your partner provides. It's beyond that. It's not asserting at all. It's basically your identity and purpose is wrapped up in the role you're playing in the partner's movie. That would be codependent. So often, a codependent and a narcissist, quote-unquote, fall in love because they get along. One says there's only one world and it's mine, and the other says, you're right, there's only one world and it's yours. So they tend to see eye to eye for a while, but when one starts to get healthier, when the narcissist tries to become considerate, or more often in pattern, when the codependent starts to get more assertive, often that relationship is doomed to a very rough time. Because it's hard for the person who's never considerate to learn how to do that. It's also hard for a person who never asserts to learn how to do that, but more commonly, they can move to recover and start to assert themselves, which makes for problems if they happen to be partnered with a narcissist. Hopefully, optimistically, what happens is they start to assert themselves and their partner starts to become more considerate because they have to. And what I mean by have to is there's all this work on personal power. If a person can cope with their life with or without their partner, then they're there by choice, which is the only way they can really truly love someone, is to be there by free will or choice. And they have the power via their independence, via their multiple coping abilities, to assert themselves, to set limits, to negotiate. So you see an addict or someone with an inadequate coping ability who's dependent on their partner, or even dependent on any element in their coping system, could be a drug as well, has a very limited ability to negotiate or set limits or come from a place of strength. which hurts their relationships in a whole variety of ways. So some things we're all addicted to, like oxygen. Gotta have it, my coping system won't work without it, it fits the definition. But so far, there's plenty around and it's free, so there's no problem getting it yet. If we're careful with our planet and careful with our environment, hopefully we can keep it that way. Clean, free air is really an important thing. I am in a way addicted to insulin because I'm a type 1 diabetic. Whatever they charge me at the pharmacy, I have to pay it because I can't live without it. Sometimes I find that frustrating or a little sad, but it is something I have to accept because I really medically have no choice at this point. But there are most other things where coping replacement is possible. And I want to be as addicted to as few things as possible. I want to have a coping system that's broad enough and strong enough that I can always find another alternative for getting a particular need or a desire met. So happily, I don't find myself addicted to my partner. I love my spouse with all my heart. One of us will lose the other at some point. That's kind of inevitable. And I would be sad, I would grieve, I would miss her. But my ability to get my needs met, my ability to exchange love with my world, friendship, my ability to support myself materially, my sense of identity as a spirit and an ego, my sense of purpose, my sense of career, all of these things and more would be intact if I had that loss to contend with. So, I would survive, wouldn't be crazy, wouldn't die by that loss. I would experience it. After grieving, life would go on. I could still be constructive. And I would want the same from her. So a healthy relationship, again, is two independent people who choose to hang out together. Neither one has to be there. And they act in mutual respect, because each demand that's assertion, and each offers that's consideration. And that is one way to define a healthy relationship. So next week I want to start to talk about patterns. As I've worked with couples over the year, there are certain patterns that tend to repeat. Every couple is unique and every individual is different, but there are patterns in how we relate that come up again and again. So I've defined a few of those, and I am going to talk with you over the next 2 weeks about some of those patterns and how they develop and what you can do about them, because for the most part, they tend to be problematic. So remember, as you develop your art of relating, go slowly. And a reminder note about slowing down is to reflect before you respond. It's one good way to slow down. So when your partner says something to you, stop and feed it back. Make sure you got it before you continue with your response. Lots of ways to slow down, but I wanted to share that note. Check multiple sources of understanding these concepts. Discuss them with the people you relate with. Practice. Remember, ground first and apply your rights. Look at the process of how you relate, which is what this program is all about. Check the website at dineskills.com. Please write in with comments or questions to Zach at kepw.org. And I hope to see you in a week with more on the art of relating. Have a good week.